At this time, even though I've tried to keep my words to a minimum, I just could not turn this over to our chairman this morning without saying a word about her, because I love her dearly. She helped to love me sober in this program. She and her husband, what's his name? Clarence. I didn't forget. Clarence is my sponsor, and I love him dearly, too. Martha was one of the originators of Al-Anon in the Atlanta area. And let's give her a big AA welcome.
Let's have a moment of silent meditation followed by the strings of prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. I'm a grateful, recovering member of the Skyland Al-Anon family group, and my name is Martha Roberts.
Hi.
I think I want to thank Vernie for encouraging me into thinking that I could do this. We'll see. Should Don Willis be in the audience, I'd like to say that I not only have the shakes, I have the vibrations and the leap. And he wouldn't like it if I didn't break his anonymity. But I really and truly feel that it's an undeserved privilege and honor to be on the same program with our speaker today. I've known and loved her for many years. I first met her husband in Miami, Florida, in 1957, and I will always be grateful to Neely for seeing to it that we got to know these people. After that meeting in 1957, I began to wonder how this Mrs. C, as he referred to her, could allow her handsome husband to come all the way from California to Miami Beach without her. And we didn't have Al-Anon. We hadn't had it very long in Atlanta at that time. And in 1959, in Winston-Salem, North Carolina, I met Elsa. And I could see she had a program. And I could identify with her because she had done some of the same dumb things that I had done, like trying to get the car keys and things like this. And she was a beautiful, intelligent woman, and I admire her so much. And we have been together in many, many places over the years, in Long Beach, California, the Royal York in Toronto, Canada, the Riviera in Palm Springs, the Fountain Blue in Miami, the Brown Palace in Denver, and many, maybe not so nice and not so big places, many others. But we were together, loving each other, and with Al-Anon and AA, and most of the time, Alateen, because our children grew up knowing and loving this couple, and I think they their lives were enriched by this. She has given me much, and to me, in my thinking, she has given more of herself and her love, and shared more with more people than any other Al-Anon that I know of in the United States. and I would like to ask you to help me in welcoming her with a warm Atlanta Southern welcome.
Good morning. I am Elsa, and I am a very, very grateful member of Al-Anon. I don't know. When people introduce me like that, I get sort of does something to me, and I don't know whether I've got anything to say or not. You know, it still kind of embarrasses me when people hand me any accolades. But the one thing that I am more grateful for than anything else, I think, is the fact that I never believed the pats on the back, and I still don't, and I think it's one of the things that I am more grateful for than anything else under the sun. Because if I did, just exactly the same as the alcoholic, if I did believe my press, I'd have been in trouble a long time ago, a long time ago. But thank God for that, and it wasn't anything that I chose to do. It was the way I was, and I couldn't help it, and I'm very grateful for it. But I'm awfully happy to be with you this morning, and I want to thank the committee for asking me to talk. I often wonder why people think I have anything to offer or to add, because every time, a lot of you have heard me talk before, and you know my story, and I wonder sometimes why in heaven's name you come back again, because it's the same story, and it doesn't change. I can't change it no matter how I try, but hopefully the things I have learned since coming to Al-Anon, I hope they grow a little bit and get a little better as I go along, because this whole program grew by experience and its lesson. We had absolutely nothing to go on in the beginning. All we had was your 12 steps, and we were shunted off into another room because the alcoholics in those days said they couldn't possibly understand. They're just a bunch of stupid women, because there were no men, you see, in our... Did you forget to have the steps? I'm going to sit down and let the man... please. Huh? What will you do, read them afterwards?
No, you just go on.
Suddenly dawned on me that there was a gentleman sitting next to me that was supposed to read the steps. And to me, that sets the tone of the meeting. Come on, come on, come on.
I reckon that's the Al-Anon program. Yeah. Most of the AA people say we're all messed up anyway. My name is Warren Dower, and I am a member of Al-Anon. Recovery through acceptance and the 12 steps. Because of their proven power and worth, AA's 12 suggested steps have been adopted almost word for word by Al-Anon. They represent a way of life appealing to all people of goodwill, of any religious faith, or of none. Note the power of the very words. One, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. Two, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. 1973, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood Him. 4, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. 5, admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. 6, were entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. 7, humbly asked Him to remove our shortcomings. 8, made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. 9, made direct amends to such people whenever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. 10, continued to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. 11, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood Him, praying only for knowledge of His will for us and the power to carry that out. 12, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to others and to practice these principles in all our affairs. Thank you. Come on, Alex.
Now I feel better. There was something missing, and I couldn't put my finger on it for a minute, but I'm glad that I remembered, and I hope you won't feel badly about it, because we all forget things, you know? And since it was her first time up here, I can certainly understand. I'm glad he read the steps, because it puts me back where I belong, too. Because those steps are as necessary to those of us who are non-alcoholic members of the family as they are to the alcoholic. Way back when I was very young and naive and inexperienced, way back, I met a young man that many of you know, sitting down there in the second row. I often wonder why he comes to hear me talk. But he does, and I appreciate it. But he was a tall, handsome guy. In fact, I think he was the best-looking thing I'd ever laid eyes on. And I fell head over heels in love with this man. And we finally decided to get married. But I remember so well something that happened on our very first date, when he said to me, and it went right over my head, he said, "You know, you and I can have a lot of fun together, but," he said, "if I ever call you for a date and you've got another date, don't lie to me, because," he said, "if I ever catch you in a lie, that's all, brother." And I think every alcoholic in the room knows exactly how why he said that. Because the expectancy of the alcoholic, of the performance of his loved ones, is really way out there somewhere. But we finally decided to get married, and we did. And I, like all young girls who have that beautiful ideal of what marriage is going to be, you know, thought this was going to be one of the most beautiful marriages in the world. We were going to have beautiful children, and life was going to be a ball. Didn't turn out that way. I can't say the first years of our marriage were bad, because they were not. But since I know, and have known for a long time, that alcoholism is a progressive illness, I, for one, stood back there and watched this illness progress. And I don't need to go into it at any depth, because all of you know exactly what it's like. The downhill travel that the alcoholic makes. But I think the reaction that the non-alcoholic has to this strange thing that's happening to the person they love is practically the same. Everywhere I talk to Al-Anon, they have felt exactly like I felt. Maybe you didn't have the feeling of unworth that I grew to have, but I think I always had it to a degree. But living with alcoholism does something to us that is not very nice. And we go downhill right straight along with the alcoholic. And we wonder, I imagine you probably have, many of you, just like I did, why? What has happened to this beautiful marriage? Why is this man that I idolized and adored and had put on such a pedestal becoming something that I don't like, that's not very pretty? Because alcoholism is an ugly disease. And it's very difficult for those of us who live with the alcoholic to understand the motivation that the alcoholic has. Because you see, in my day, we didn't know anything about alcoholism. Chuck's been sober 33, 34 years. Which is it, Chuck? 33. And long before he came to AA, no one ever heard the word alcoholic. It hadn't been born yet. They were just common, ordinary, low-down drunks, and everybody looked down their noses at them, and nobody had any understanding or any appreciation of what was the matter. And you never heard that an alcoholic was a sick person. Never heard it. So we tried in every way we could to find out why this man was performing the way he was. I went to many people trying to understand, and to me it was a case of weak spine, pull yourself up by your bootstraps, make up your mind. If you just would make up your mind, you wouldn't have to drink so much. I wonder if you Al-Anons today really appreciate what you have. Because I know what it was like when we didn't have anything. And believe me, if you are not grateful for your program of Al-Anon today, you need to learn a little more about it. Because believe me, not knowing what's the matter with these people is a ghastly, ghastly way to live. You try everything under the sun that you can think of, and nothing, but nothing ever works. Nothing works. During those last 10 years of Chuck's drinking, he became a periodic drinker. And I should have said that along the way we had 2 sons, 6 years apart. Because I'm going to talk about those boys a little bit later. Because of the fact that most of us today are having problems with our kids. But I'm going to leave that to later. The thing that I want to show you is the disintegration of a family, if I can, to the point where the harm is done not only to the wife, but to the children and to everyone around them, especially when they don't understand and when there are no answers for them as a family. The time finally came with me during those last 10 years when I became, I think, as crazy as Chuck was. I don't know how sane I was before, because when I look back at my own childhood, I cannot blame alcoholism for everything that was wrong with me that I found out later on. Because every defect of character that I found after I began to work on myself was there long before I ever met Chuck. But it was exaggerated and made worse by living with alcoholism. And I think that's what happens to most of us. But we cannot blame the alcoholic for everything. But there were many times during that last 10 years when I tried desperately in the back of my mind to figure out some way that I could get rid of this guy and not get found out. Because he had become something that I did not even recognize as the same man. I did not know then that underneath all of this crud that was so apparent was still the man that I had fallen in love with in the first place. But it was all covered up with a bunch of illness and sickness and state of mind that I didn't even know about. Because, you see, when he got sober, he became again the man I had fallen in love with in the first place. So it was always there. It was always there, but it was always covered up. Things happened to me during those last 10 years that are not very nice either. And I finally, when I could see that Chuck was one of the ones that had to go completely to the bottom before he could give up, and it had become so bad that it was almost a continuous thing, I finally had to, I guess I was pushed against a stone wall that I couldn't get away from. And I finally had to give up myself any necessity that he should straighten up and fly right. Now, I would like to underline that word necessity, because I think that's the thing that we Al-Anons have to give up, is that God-awful necessity that our mates or our children or our friends or whoever it may be should straighten up and fly right and go the way we think they should. Because, you know, it's a funny thing. When I gave up the necessity that Chuck gets sober, he got sober. And I believe that this is the way it works. Because as long as you and I are determined that everybody out there perform the way we think they should, we're in trouble. Because nobody ever does. And to learn that everybody is doing the very best that he or she can at the level of understanding in which they are at the moment. That's not an easy one to do, because we've been brought up to think that we are our brother's keeper, and I don't believe we are. I think we have enough to do to take care of our own lives, because it seems that when we take care of our lives, everything around us seems to kind of straighten out. And that seems to be the way, that's the way it worked with me. And that's the only way I know what works and what doesn't work, is what has worked and what doesn't work with me. I decided that the jig was up, that he never was going to get sober, he was going to die or go insane, because he had had many, many alcoholic convulsions, and he saw many things that weren't there, and he was a bed drinker. I think if there are any of you in this room that have lived with a bed drinker, you know exactly what I'm talking about. And I don't have to go into detail. But the funny part of it was that when I made up my mind that it was all over, and I started divorce proceedings, and I started out to business school to try to learn some way to earn my own living, because I had had no training. I was a housewife and a mother. I had had some public work, which had been fairly successful, but I'd gotten to the age where I could no longer do that. And as I say, it wasn't more than 3 months after I started to business school, and I was practice typing Oh, I'll have to tell you this, because this just kills me every time I think about it. I was practice typing in our breakfast room, to the best of my ability, I was so nervous that I'd practically jump out of my skin. But I was doing the best I could, because I knew I was going to have to take care not only of my mother, but my two kids. And you don't make enough clerking in a department store, for instance, to take care of four people. It's impossible. So I was practice typing in the kitchen, and the sound was going right through the floor into the bedroom where Chuck was lying. If any of you have been through this experience, you'll know what I mean. He used to come out and dog me because the noise was bothering him, trying to get me to quit practice typing, and here I was trying to get myself in some kind of shape where I could earn some money to take care of this family, and he was over me all the time. Do you wonder that I couldn't learn to practice type? I haven't learned to practice type yet. But at any rate, he did get sober, and he came to the program. And I was so delighted that I didn't know what to do, because there was such a sudden change in this man. From this ugly person that I had been living with to someone who was a... Well, let me put it this way. The ego was gone, and I think you know what I'm talking about. The ego was gone, and I recognized this before he did, that something had changed. Something was very, very different. And I went to meetings with him continuously for 6 long years before Al-Anon was born. Now, those of us who go to Al-Anon and do not have to AA with our husbands or with our wives and do not have a program of our own sometimes think that we have all we need, that it's not necessary to go to Al-Anon. I'm sorry. Because we have been going to AA all this time, and we've listened, and we've read the book, and we know all the answers, and we don't need anything else. But believe me, that's not true, because I had to find out for myself. But I had to find out the hard way. And when Lois Wilson came to the coast and suggested that those of us members of the families of alcoholics needed a program very desperately for ourselves. 3 of us were sitting at a table in the old 6300 Club in Los Angeles. I don't know whether any of you know that old club. You're probably not old enough. And we said to each other, Beverly Hills needs this very desperately. Let's start a meeting in Beverly Hills, which we proceeded to do at my home. And I led that meeting for a long time because, you see, I'd been going to AA meetings for 6 long years and I knew a lot. I had read the book several times and the chapter to wives and the family afterward, and I thought I knew a great deal. Now, I don't think my motive was bad in starting that meeting, because I did it to help somebody, didn't I? That's not a bad motive, is it? But it's not good enough. It's not good enough. I led that meeting for a long time because everybody that was coming in was brand new and knew absolutely nothing about the program. And I was the grandma of that group, and everybody depended upon me for the good word, you know? But after that meeting had been going about 4 years, we sold our home in Beverly Hills and moved to Laguna Beach, where we live today, into the home of our dreams that AA had made it possible for us to have, high on a hill with a perfectly magnificent view of the little town of Laguna and the ocean and Catalina Island, the place that this program and you people had made it possible for us to have, because we came into AA with absolutely nothing. Everything was gone. Everything was gone. So we moved down to Laguna into my dream house. And finally, when I get things organized and the house was the way I wanted it to be, I suddenly discover that I'm alone an awful lot, because my husband's business was still in Los Angeles and he was going in every day. Well, most of you know that this guy talks a great deal. That's putting it mildly. So here we are. Now, Laguna Beach is about halfway between Los Angeles and San Diego. Quite a bit farther than where we were in Beverly Hills. So he doesn't have time when he's talking or going to make a 12-step call. He doesn't have time to come home for dinner. So here I sit in my dream house, most of the time all by myself. And I think every Al-Anon in the room will know exactly what happened to me. All of this good knowledge that I had up in my head went out the window. And it didn't take very long until I began to feel so sorry for me that it was just too bad. Here I'd spent all these years living with a drunk and all this time working with non-alcoholics, and I was not getting my just due, my proper respect, you see. Now, you see, I had thought of myself as always having been such a good woman all my life. I was the one that took care of the kids, you see. I was the one that kept the house in order. I was the one that was Johnny on the spot at things they were doing in school when Chuck was out like a light. And I thought of myself as being the perfect wife and the perfect mother. By this time, of course, our children were grown and gone, and I was all by myself. Well, believe me, when you are all by yourself, no matter what your surroundings are, things happen if you're not awfully careful. Now, there was no Al-Anon in Laguna Beach at that time. There was one meeting in Santa Ana and one in Corona del Mar, and I went to the one in Corona del Mar a few times, but I didn't particularly like it. So I didn't go back very often. And I thought the one in Santa Ana was much too far, and I didn't particularly want to drive over there at night by myself, and so I didn't go. And I just stayed at home and stewed my own juice. And I began to put pressure on Chuck to slow down. Have any of you ever done that? After all, you've been talking all these years. Isn't it time you slowed down and gave me a little more of your attention? Sounds logical, doesn't it? After all. And you know, the poor guy could see how unhappy I was. And he tried. He tried very desperately to slow down. And he would only take maybe one or two talks a week. And he'd tell the rest of them, "I'm sorry, I can't come. I need to stay at home." And he did. But Thanksgiving came along. And the children came down for Thanksgiving. And we were all sitting around the table. And right in the middle of dinner, Chuck said, "I've got to say something." He said, "I've been trying very desperately to slow down and give your mother more of my time. And I'm getting so uncomfortable, I can't stand it." He said, "I owe this program my life. This is my life, my love, my dedication. And whatever I need to do in AA, I have got to do. And you will have to adjust yourself to it." Well, I didn't like it very well. But I had to accept it, because this husband of mine is a very strong man, and I knew he meant exactly what he said. So I wondered what in the world I was going to do. Christmas came along shortly after Thanksgiving, and he had a date to talk in Santa Monica on Christmas, and I just raised the roof. I said, how dare you? How dare you make a date on Christmas? This is a family day. You haven't any right to make a date on Christmas. But if you know Chuck, if he makes a date, he's going to keep it. So I planned an early dinner, and the children were there. But the thing that makes me laugh today, you know, hindsight is about is a lot more valuable than foresight, believe me. But in looking back on that, I have to laugh. Because those kids came to spend Christmas with the old folks, and about an hour and a half after dinner, they all left. They had things they wanted to do. They had open houses, they were young, they liked to drink, they were gone to all sorts of things that they needed to do, and we were left alone anyway. So I got dressed and went to the meeting with Chuck, much against my will. But at that meeting, there were two very, very drunk winos that had just been pulled out from under the Santa Monica Pier. The following Christmas, he was asked to talk again. And I went a little more willingly this time, not too much so. Here a whole year had gone by after that first one, and I hadn't learned hardly anything, not hardly anything. But I went with him. But lo and behold, one of those winos was leading that meeting, and the other one read the steps. And they told us afterwards that they had not heard one word that Chuck had said that year before. They were too drunk. The thing they did remember, though, was that a husband and wife would leave their children on Christmas and come to share at an AA meeting. And for the first time in my life, I could see what you and I have in this program. Both in AA and Al-Anon, we are in the business of saving lives. We are in the business of helping people. And whatever my husband has to do in order to fulfill his obligation, if you will, his love and his trust, I have to leave him free to do. Free. That's what this program is all about. Freedom. Freedom. But what about me? What am I going to do about me? And my youngest son gave me the answer. He said, Mom, it's so simple, it's ridiculous. Why don't you start another Al-Anon group? Been there all the time, and it never occurred to me. Here I didn't have any Al-Anon. Start one, for God's sake, start one. If any of you ever move to a new area where there is no Al-Anon, for God's sake, get busy and start one. Because there are people in every area that need this program. Somebody's got to get it started and get it going. And that beautiful meeting, which took a long time to grow, first there were two, and then there'd be one, and then there'd be three, and then there'd be two, and it took a while to build. But then it began to grow, and it outgrew the house. And we had to move out of the house and move into the Canyon Club. And then we had to move from the Canyon Club to a church. And now we've moved to another church because they were tearing down the old church. And our meeting runs around 50 every Monday noon. And it's a whale of a meeting, and it's a good meeting. And it's a basic meeting, and we don't talk about the alcoholic at all. If you think we do, you're crazy. That isn't what we're there for, and there are lots of alcoholics that think that Al-Anon is a discussion of the alcoholic. Let me disabuse your mind immediately, because it is not. We go to Al-Anon to do something about ourselves. And it has absolutely nothing to do with the alcoholic. But you see, the funny part of it is that up there in Beverly Hills, I had a motive, and it was a good one, to help you. But you see, when I started the one in Laguna, it was totally different. I needed you. You didn't need me. I needed you, and I needed you desperately because I was miserable. And I guess I've always been the kind that has to be pushed against a stone wall before I will do something about me. But you taught me many things. You taught me how to be more honest with me. Because I had to discover that I had never been really honest with myself. And I wasn't always too honest with you. Because I had a terrible, terrible need for your approval. And a desperate fear of your disapproval, which caused me always to be something that I was not. I was always trying to be like somebody else. And I had learned in my youth, when I first started doing dramatic things, and I was playing the piano and singing, I learned how to put on a front. And I see it often in my own, amongst my own people, that terrible front that will not let you know how I felt inside. Because I felt like I was a stupid idiot. There's something that happens to us living with an alcoholic, a practicing alcoholic, and sometimes even a sober one, that has a tendency to push us down and push us down and make us feel as though we didn't have a brain in our head. But that is something that you and I allow to happen, and we don't have to. Because strangely enough, I have found out that there is a great difference between being intelligent and being wise. There's a great difference. And I think that that's what this program teaches us, is how to become wise, at least wiser than we were. And when I began to see that this terrible need for approval and fear of disapproval was the thing that was causing me to put on that terrible, calm, serene front, and people would say to me, oh, I wish I could be as serene and comfortable as you, and I would say in the back of my mind, if you just knew, if you just knew. But I heard a gal say one time in one of our meetings something that hit me right between the eyes. She said that her effort had been one of trying to make the inside match the outside. And our speaker last night said something about that, and I enjoyed his talk so much. And I sat there last night and I thought, what really is the difference between the non-alcoholic in this program and the alcoholic after you take alcohol out of it? We don't happen to have the allergy, but my God, I identify with the things that you say about how you felt and how you lived. What's the difference? Maybe you go overboard more than we do, I don't know. But I recognize so much in the alcoholic that is the same as I have. And I've heard so many, many alcoholics say that a need for approval and a fear of disapproval was one of their greatest stumbling blocks. And it certainly was mine. And I began to see a lot of things in myself that I had never been willing or honest enough to admit to anybody else. I knew it myself, but I never would admit it to anyone else. I had to be what I thought you wanted me to be. And that's a lousy way to live, really. It is. I thought that everybody was making book on me and was watching me, and I had to be so careful that you didn't know. And there was a thing that came out in the grapevine many years ago, and it's been repeated several times, and maybe you've read it, that said people wouldn't be so concerned about what other people think about them if they knew how seldom they do. You talk about ego. We non-alcoholics are inclined, I think many of us, to have as much ego as the alcoholic has, but I call it a reverse ego. I'm not worthy, I'm not worthy, I'm not worthy, you know? But it's just as much ego as to say I'm better than anybody and I'm a hotshot. I don't think it makes any difference. Because it's all self-thinking. Every bit of it is self-thinking. And as is said so often in this program, self-thinking is insanity. It really is. And those of us who live with alcoholism, I think, are almost as insane as the alcoholic, because many of us, end up in laughing academies. Many of us get into a car and drive all over Hicks Room in a total blackout without any booze at all and can't even remember where we've been. We're sick. Let's face it, we're sick people. But thank God for this program, because we do have a way to get well and to find out that we are not the arbiters of the universe and that we cannot force other people into our patterns, that we have enough to do to take care of ourselves and make our lives as good and as comfortable and as loving as we possibly can. That serenity prayer, always, I love it. Because you see, we have to find out that we are powerless also, completely powerless, not only over our own lives but over others, and that our lives are totally unmanageable. And that first step in our program is one that we can take without any reservation whatsoever. We are completely powerless. And that second step, which meant so much to me when I finally could accept it, we came to believe over a period of time and with much effort and much trying, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us, the non-alcoholic, to some form of serenity and peace of mind. And it wasn't quite that easy to turn my will and my life over to him. I had been raised, fortunately or unfortunately, I don't know which, in a religion that does not teach fear. And yet I grew to know terrible fear during those drinking years. And what spirituality I had went out the window. And I can't remember, believe it or not, when I really, honestly, got down on my knees and prayed. I never did. I don't understand it. I think I was crazier than the alcoholic during those years. But at any rate, when I began to look at me, and I could see the selfishness, because I'm an only child. And only children, I think, grow up to be pretty selfish. And I had been taught that I had to judge my neighbor and people. And I had been taught a lot of things that I had to get rid of and undo. And I think we all have. Because organized religion lots of times teaches us some of the things that we have to get rid of in this program. Now, some of you may not agree with me when I say that, and that's okay. Each one of us is an individual, and each one of us has a right to our own pathway to whatever God we choose. And that, to me, is the reason for, as we understand him in our steps, each one of us in our own way.
A very dear friend of Chuck's and mine said something many years ago that both Chuck and I have talked about and used for a long time, but it took me a long time to really understand it. And he said, if God had made two of us exactly alike, one of us would be unnecessary. Took me a long time to figure that one out. But I had to come to see that each one of us is a distinct individual, and there's no one else quite like each one of us on the face of the earth. So if each one of us is an individual, and no one else is quite like you on the face of the earth, why do we think it's necessary to be like somebody else? We don't have to. And he went on to say that if each one of us does not make our own unique contribution to this life, it won't be made. Now that makes you pretty special, doesn't it? Each one of you pretty special. So why do I, as an individual, unique child of God, feel that I have to beat my breast and say, I'm not worthy, I'm not worthy, I'm not worthy? All I have to do, really, and all I have done, is to try, in the best way that I know how, to get a little better, and a little better, and a little better, and get rid of the discards, the things that we don't need and don't like. I became more and more comfortable with me. But something happened later on that threw me for a loop. I don't always tell this story, but I've been asked to tell it because there are so many who have difficulties with their children. And I think it epitomizes what this program does for us in the end. I'm sure it does. I have two sons, and as I told you, they're 6 years apart. We have two sons, I should say. That's a mistake that none of us should ever, ever make. Because they're two of us, you know, that they belong to. The other day in Texas, a gal knelt down in front of me at one of the meetings, and she said, Elsa, why don't you ever talk about the older son? And I looked at her and I thought, by George, you know that's right. I very rarely ever talk about my eldest son. I always tell this story, if I'm asked to, about my youngest son. And she said, I'm oldest in our family. And I would like to have you talk about your eldest son. So before I go into the story of my youngest son, I'm going to tell you that my eldest son is a great guy. I thought for a while he was going was going to join his father. He's 6'4" and the handsomest thing you ever saw. Beautiful guy. But you know the thing that I have had to learn, and I've got to tell you this before I forget it because it tickles the hell out of me. Pardon my language. The big boy, the oldest, looks like his father. The youngest, unfortunately, looks like me. But the funny part of it is the eldest thinks like me and the youngest thinks like his dad. And the youngest has never had any problem with booze. Never any problem with booze. He drinks, but he drinks when he wants to, and he doesn't drink when he doesn't want to. If he's on a picture, he won't touch the stuff. And he goes out and kicks up his heels every once in a while. The older boy likes to drink. He really likes to drink. And as I said, he We thought for a while maybe he was going to have a problem, but I'm afraid he's just one of those strange people that just goes along like this and never gets any worse and never gets any better, you know? And he is now 52 years old, and if he were going to be a drunk like his father, he'd have done it before now. Chuck was 43 when he came into this program. So that's the eldest boy. Now, you can't criticize me for not talking about the oldest boy. And I love him very dearly, and he's a dear boy. But for the sake of those of you who have had problems with your kids, I'm going to talk a little bit about the youngest. One night when Chuck was off talking, as usual, and I was sitting at home by myself, and the telephone rang, and it was my youngest. And for the first time in his life, and he was in his late 20s at the time, for the first time in his life, I heard him so angry that he was just about to tear the telephone off by its roots. He was fit to be tied because I had given an interview to a movie magazine that he didn't like. And he said, "You should have consulted the studio." And I said, "I didn't know I was supposed to consult the studio." And he went on and on and on about this lousy article, and he didn't like it at all. And then he took off on his father. And I found out that he hated his father and that he thought his father was the biggest phony he'd ever seen in his life, that he was just a marvelous speaker, and he had a lot of words, but he didn't mean a thing that he said. And then he took off on me. And he thought I was a dimwit and a stupid idiot to have stayed with him as long as I did. Well, you could have knocked me over with a feather. I knew there was some sort of alienation, but I did not know how severe it was, because this boy is one who all his life had pushed down anger, pushed down resentment, pushed down bitterness, and all it took to come out was something of this nature, and it exploded over me that night. I think every mother in the room will know exactly what it did to me. It tore me apart. And I could not believe what I heard on the telephone. And of course I was by that time was in tears. And he finally said, "Maybe I better come down and talk to you." And I said, "No, I'd rather you wouldn't." Because I had to do some thinking about this, because it was such a terrible surprise. So we hung up the phone, and I thought, I can't let Chuck know. I can't let him know what his son has said about him. It would absolutely destroy him and hurt him so terribly. So I got to bed before Chuck got home so that he wouldn't see my swollen eyes and tear-stained face. And the next morning, my eyes had gone down to their proper size. And I thought I was putting on the usual front. I was a master at this, master at putting on a front. And he did not realize that anything had gone wrong that night. And during the next few days, before my meeting came, I walked the floor when he was gone, trying to understand what had happened to my family. After all these years in the program, it was all going out the window. And Monday came along, and I went down to my meeting, and I thought that I was going in with the same face and same attitude that I had always had. But you are an intuitive bunch. And my group took a look at me, and they said, "What's the matter, Elsa? You're hurting." And I broke down and told them what had happened. And do you know what that bunch said to me? They said, "Why, Elsa? You told us this. Why, Elsa? You said that. You're not practicing what you preach." That's kind of a hard knock, you know, coming on top of what my son had said. It was a little rough. But I could see that there was something very definite that I needed to do eventually. It took a little time, I will say. I wrote a letter to my son trying to explain what had happened to us since AA and Al-Anon. On foolscap about that big, on both sides, about 4 or 5 sheets of it, explaining us to him. I think most of you know that I did not send it. I still have it as a reminder. But the thing that I began to learn with the help of my group was this, that I was completely powerless over what my son thought about us. I was completely powerless over what he thought about his father. That was something that was between the boy and his father, and that I could not interfere. I also had to find out that I must definitely take my son and put him lovingly in God's hands and leave him free to find his own answers in his own time, in his own way. But then what about me? I had to eventually find that in completely letting go of the necessity to have my son's love, that I finally was free myself, and I could then come back and live my life with my husband and leave my children free to find themselves. And with the help of Al-Anon and many of my AA friends, I began to get some peace and joy again within myself. And when I say to you that we Al-Anons are as bad as AAs in wanting everything to happen right now, or yesterday, as some of you say, we are that way too. But I had to see that I had to let it go and let it work out in God's time, not in my time. And it took 3 more years. One night, Chuck and I were sitting just quietly in our living room, looking out at the beautiful ocean and the view, not thinking about much of anything. And out of a clear blue sky, Chuck said to me, "I've got to call the boy and make an appointment with him." It seems that he had been working with several children of alcoholics. And in doing so, he had suddenly found out that he had exactly the same problem with his own son that these kids had with their parents. This is the first time that it had ever occurred to Chuck that he had amends to make to this boy. And he called him and he made an appointment. And they sat around the table in the middle of a big restaurant. And he tried to explain to the boy what had changed in him and how he could see what the harm he had done. Because you see, during the boy's growing up years, his loves were art, drama, and music, the same as mine. And Chuck couldn't understand this, and neither could the eldest son understand it, because they were both athletes and businessmen, and they thought they had a real strange kid on their hands. But when they finally got together, and shortly after that we went clear to England to get acquainted with our youngest son, something many parents need to do to get acquainted with our children, where we can admit our own faults and our own lack of knowledge about certain things to our kids and not talk down to them as we have such a tendency to do from our pedestal of being a parent. And the whole situation has changed so dramatically that I just can't tell you the difference. Because whereas this boy grew up a complete loner, he wouldn't let anybody in his circle. In fact, I couldn't even put my arm around him. He would shrug me away. He'd come home from school and go in his bedroom and shut the door. Complete loner. Today, because of this program and before the God of the, and by the God of this program, when he comes down to see us today, he comes in the door and he grabs me around the waist and lifts me off my feet and kisses me right smack dab on the mouth. "Hi, Mom, I love you." And I could just die. You see, it doesn't make any difference what the area is where we're having problems. It all works out just exactly the same way if we allow it. But we're such busybodies and we want to fix everything. And we can't fix everything. And each one of us as an individual has the right and the dignity as one of God's children to find our own answers in our own time, in our own way. And the thing that I just love today is that when this boy comes down to visit us in Laguna and sits there in the living room talking with his father about spiritual things, something that Chuck used to try to cram down his throat, and now they sit there, and strangely enough, the boy has become interested in the same philosophies and everything else that his dad has. And it's really something, because now I can see so clearly that these two, who were so alienated for so long, are of a mind. And strangely enough, the eldest boy is getting interested in the same thing and is able to come down and the three of them sit there and discuss. And it's all due to you people. All due to you people and this beautiful program and your willingness to share with us and our willingness to share with you and the great love that we have for each other. Because those of us in Al-Anon are trying to do in our own way exactly what you people are trying to do in AA. We're trying to learn how to live peacefully, joyously, and comfortably with everybody, without expectancy, but with love. And it's a beautiful way to go. And God bless you all, and thank you so much for asking us to come.